Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth of PaleoParents.com. You might also know me as the broth lady or the inventor of the hashtag more vegetables than a vegetarian. I'm the co-author of several paleo cookbooks, including Eat Like a Dinosaur, Beyond Bacon, Real Life Paleo. I like to talk about health at any size and self-love and personal acceptance. Specifically, I have a love for lifting heavy things. If you're interested in finding more out about that, you can also find me on Strong Woman Radio.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Valentine, the PaleoMom.com. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of The Paleo Approach and The Paleo Approach Cookbook. I'm passionate about nutrient density and the intersection of diet and lifestyle with health, which really means I just love talking about science.
News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up and you get to listen to our gossip.
So, Stacey, I'm sorry you're not feeling well.
Thank you. I really don't like feeling ill, but I feel like I might have actually brought this one on myself, so can't really complain. Maybe it's a lesson. I ate out a bunch yesterday and had a drink, which I don't usually do because it's Matt and I's anniversary. And
happy anniversary. Is that 12?
13.
13. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's a long time to be with the same person. His face is the same every day. No, I'm kidding. It's awesome, and we're super excited, and that's why we went out to dinner, and we had a lovely dinner at a restaurant that I took Danielle to, and they took really great care and caution about their kitchen. So I don't know if it was one of the meals that I ate earlier in the day, or the drink, or it just happens to be coincidence that I have something that feels like the stomach flu / food poisoning. So it's, you know, there's better things, but there's also way worse things. And I'm hoping that if I go to bed right after this, I'll wake up feeling awesome.
Well, I hope you do. I hope. And maybe that's good incentive for us to keep our show to the length that we normally try to keep it to and then never actually succeed at keeping it to. I think that's good incentive. And So I went to CrossFit today for the first time in about 2 months.
Holy moly.
I know. And then for the 2 months before that, because I was really at the beginning of this whole Hashimoto's thyroiditis crisis of not funness. That's what I'm going to call it right now.
It's a good formal name.
Right. But for the 2 months up to that, I was really only getting in like once every week or week and a half. I was doing a lot of travel. It was really sporadic. And then I basically have not gone at all since I think the last time was right before Thanksgiving. So not quite 2 months ago was the last time I went. And so I emailed my coach and I talked to Bowen, you know, told him everything that was going on. I said, like, I really want to get back into it, but I know that I can't handle the wads. Maybe some of them I can do with a lot of scaling, but I really just want to come in and do the warm up and the mobility and the strength and then just see how that goes and listen to my body. But like right now, my body's highly inflamed. I'm extremely fatigued. I have really, really bad joint and muscle pain. I've had loss of coordination. I fell down the stairs last week. That's just an embarrassing thing that I just told a lot of people.
Well.
My husband teased me and said, you can't blame everything on hashies. You might just be clumsy. I didn't hurt myself. I just kind of like lost my footing and then went thump, 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 thump on my behind, like down 6 stairs. And I was fine. I screamed because I was scared, but I was totally fine. It was just one of those things that I don't normally do, you know, fall down the stairs. And so I went in today and it was like, you know, I was like seeing all these friends that I haven't seen and everyone's like, hey, where you've been? I'm like, well, you know, it's a long story, but the short form is I've been sick. And they're like, oh, that sucks. And so we did our strength was back squats and I took it really easy. And I started with a technique bar and then I just started adding weight to it. And I didn't kind of follow, you know, what everyone else is doing. I just sort of did my own thing. And I ended up doing a lot of sets, moving up really, really slowly. But I got up to 125 pounds, which is not too off of what I should have been doing. And it felt really great. Like it was such a nice thing to kind of see that I hadn't really lost that much strength. And then the WOD was Helen, which is running, kettlebell swings, and pull-ups. And you You do three rounds of that. And so I basically swapped out the running for a really light row with the resistance set like really low. So just really just moving my body, but not really a lot of effort, and used the lightest kettlebell and then did banded pull-ups. So I had a lot of help and I felt really good doing it. Oh, holy smokes, am I tired now? I really want to go to bed. So it felt really good to kind of, it felt like my life is starting to return a little bit to normal, which was a nice feeling because it's really just been feeling like one thing after another of like not funness. So it's been a hard few months, which is kind of a good segue into our guest today. So the day that I was diagnosed, which was 12 days ago, I don't know how much I shared about this last week, but my doctor literally, we were going through a bunch of test results. He literally turned the page and I saw my thyroid panel and I started to cry. And he sort of made a joke about like, wow, I don't have that many patients who can read their own test results and diagnose themselves based on them. But it was, you know, like for me, I knew exactly what those numbers meant. And it was just the beginning of this sort of realizations and that the different perspective that it gave most of my life that I've been enjoying is a hard word for that, but that I've been looking at and reflecting on for the last nearly 2 weeks. And so like the first person I called was my husband, and then I called my mom, and then I texted you, and then I called Mickey Trescott. And it was like, those were the only people I told that day. Like it was, you know, it was like, okay, you know, got to tell my husband and got to tell my mom, Stacy, I need to curse in a text message to you a little bit.
And then, cause I'm like, your bad friend.
Right. And then Mickey is my, like, Mickey will know what to do. She'll know what this feels like. She'll understand this conflict of emotions. She'll ask me really good questions. Mickey has been this like, I mean, Mickey's always been a great friend, but in the last 2 weeks, Mickey's been my like rock. Like, so when my fingers turned blue last week, I, you know, was texting the nurse at the doctor's office and I was texting Mickey, and it was like, you know, back and forth. And, you know, like, do you think it was this supplement? Do you think like what could have triggered it? And so it's been really nice to have that compassionate ear and that knowledgeable ear, but it's been really just wonderful to have that support. So I'm just like super stoked to have Mickey on the show today. And we're going to kind of do our podcast last week got such a tremendous amount of attention and excitement, and people just really resonated with the discussion. And it turns out that this whole Hashimoto's thyroiditis is like a club and it's huge. Fun fact, autoimmune thyroid diseases are the most common autoimmune diseases. So it's a very big club and a very tight knit club. And it was kind of a not fun way to be initiated into it. And I think we need to talk, club, about our initiation process here. But, you know, it's been really neat to see this very, very large group of people be, you know, so supportive and really resonate with a lot of the stuff that I'm going through and have really good questions. And as I'm educating myself, it feels like a topic that there's a lot more to say compared to what we said last week. So we're going to do like the Hashimoto's podcast episode part two. And we're going to be joined by the awesome Mickey Trescott, who is like a super duper expert on the autoimmune protocol and Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And she's a nutritional therapist. And hi, Mickey.
Hi, Sarah. I'm so bummed that I have to be advising one of my favorite people in the world on something that I know so well. I think I told you that on the phone, but I'm happy to help you and happy to help anyone else that you know, wants to know anything about Hashimoto's, because it's really tricky. And as you found out, there's a couple complex issues with people with Hashimoto's that they have some unique things. And it's a really delicate process trying to regain your health and regain balance. And especially after the initial diagnosis, you kind of go, oh my gosh, what do I do? Like, I need help. But you're kind of at that beginning spot. So I really feel for you. And yeah, it's tough.
One of the things I talked about last week was being in this, I think, relatively unique, or at least less common situation of being a person who has the diet really dialed in, and being a person who, you know, puts effort into activity and sleep and stress management, although clearly not enough over the fall. But to kind of already have that aspect of it. So, you know, for me, it's sort of a question of, you know, tightening things up and making it as perfect as I can, but also sort of just waiting for the medications to kick in. And it's, I think, a lot of people sort of where the situation's reversed, where they're getting a diagnosis and they're looking up diet changes at the same time as they're waiting for the drugs to kick in, or they've been on, you know, something like Synthroid for like 20 years and now they're finally figuring out how important diet is. I think that when you're doing it the other way, not everyone, but certainly there's this higher capacity to feel a lot better really quickly. One of the women at my gym this morning was telling me about her friend with Hashimoto's thyroiditis, and she spent the last 3 years basically every doctor's appointment going up in her thyroid medication dose. And she decided to do a whole 30 for New Year's, and now she's having all the hyperthyroid symptoms, like all of a sudden where like her heart's racing and it's her like respiration rate is really high. And, you know, the question for me was like, is that possible that she like already needs like lower thyroid medicine just 2 weeks into paleo? And I'm like, yes, it is. And so it's kind of, you know, for me, I've got that like extra little bit of frustration in the sense that, you know, well, definitely sleep's been a problem for me, and I'm trying to work on not sleep quantity. My sleep quantity is awesome. My sleep quality is pretty terrible. So I'm like working on that and then trying to, you know, do whatever sort of adjunct things that I can. Can I tell you guys the new thing that I'm starting on Wednesday?
Yeah,
sure.
I am going to be starting IV nutritional therapy.
Interesting. I would be very curious to hear how that goes. I know that's something that Dr. Lowe does, and I've never seen anybody else do that.
So my functional medicine doctor does it, and they basically find, you know, it basically reduces inflammation really quickly. So it's an IV, and you get a bag of liquid, but it's the complete nutrition that's given to, you know, hospital patients that can't eat and that, you know, need that nutrition. And then it's supplemented with some really neat nutrients. The one that I'm most excited about is glutathione. So it's glutathione is the body's main antioxidant, and it tends to be deficient in people with autoimmune disease. And so this is like, here's some glutathione directly into your bloodstream, and it's a major antioxidant. And so what, you know, my doctor says is that he basically, I mean, for me, it's not so much about kickstarting my thyroid so much as dealing with the large amount of inflammation in my body as quickly as possible and seeing if we can get that down, which will help my thyroid, but kind of help everything, right? It should help the joint pains and the muscle aches and the fatigue and the chills and the whole, it should help all of that stuff. So, I'm, other than being tethered to a chair for an hour or two, that doesn't sound all that exciting to me, but I'm kind of interested to see how it goes. And I've researched it, and I think it's kind of a neat idea, because the idea is it's addressing nutrient deficiencies by bypassing the GI tract. So, you know, when we get into this sort of nutritional therapy side of things, and we're taking a lot of targeted supplements, like even if you've done, which I always sort of recommend, do the micronutrient tests and see if you have deficiencies, and then do targeted supplementation. But if there's something going on with your digestive tract and you're not really absorbing those very well, or you're missing some important cofactors, or you have, you know, some kind of genetic factor that's making it harder for you to absorb or use those nutrients, this kind of bypasses all of that by just sticking it directly into the blood. So I'm excited. So I'll go every week for at least a month, and then it'll be less frequent after that.
Awesome.
Yeah, I am being a guinea pig for everybody.
I know you're going to like the glutathione, because it's something that I used when I started with functional medicine and my Hashimoto's. And it's not something that you can get from a supplement. It actually, once the stomach breaks it down, it's worthless. But I've used liposomal glutathione and I've used transdermal, and it really works well.
I didn't even know it was available, transdermal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a cream, but the company that makes it, they put a lot of other stuff in it, like in a bunch of immune stimulants. So I found when I was using the cream that I could use it for like a few days, but then I would start to get an allergic reaction. So I found a liposomal kind that I take in my mouth, and a lot of them are soy-based, but there is a company that makes sunflower-based, which isn't AIP, but.
Well, but at the same time, it's not like whole sunflower, right? It's probably the oils from sunflower.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's all fat.
Yeah. So that's probably not as problematic as some of, you know, it's the proteins in nuts and seeds that are typically the problem. So I have, as a autoimmune protocol advisory person, that being my new official title, I worry less about the isolated oils. You know, in that case, it's really the only major problem is omega-6 is an omega-3s, with the exception of the reason why soy oil isn't so great is because a lot of the phytoestrogens are fat soluble and they're bound up with the fats. So you get the omega-6s, which are not so great, but then you also get all the estrogen mimicking compounds in soy, which can be a really big problem for a lot of people. So generally I don't worry so much about the nut and seed oils, but I still don't like the bad oils like soy and peanut and canola. All those. That's a tangent. So Mickey, are you actually on the road now?
I am. I am in Manhattan Beach, California.
Well, that sounds really rough. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's like horrible. Right. Let me tell you.
So, Mickey, I didn't get an opportunity to thank you for being on the show. Sarah is filling in for more than her half today, given my situation. But we got to meet when Sarah and I were on tour in Portland, and then you graciously offered to drive to Seattle and come to the Seattle event as well. And so I just want to welcome you to the show and hear about your travel adventures and how your book is doing. Because I know when we spoke, it was a huge undertaking for you to get your self-published physical books in stores, which is something I'm not really familiar with, but I think is super awesome. So how's that going?
Yeah, thanks, Stacey. Yeah, that was a really fun little time we had, a little adventure, weekend adventure in the Pacific Northwest.
It was perfect because we left at, well, it didn't feel perfect because I was so exhausted, but we left kind of at sunrise, and like just the Pacific Northwest was gorgeous. And
yeah, it was a beautiful time to be driving. I'll tell you, it can definitely be pretty crappy that time of year here. So you got really lucky. But yeah, so my husband and I are traveling, promoting the Autoimmune Paleo Cookbook, which people are probably like, WTF, that book came out like over a year ago. But my book is self-published, so I only released it on Amazon, and then I spent about 6 to 9 months hammering out, a distribution deal, which is kind of hard to do when you publish your own book. But I figured it out, and the book came out January 6th in stores, and so I decided I would go on a book tour. So we're going up and down the West Coast. We went all the way down to San Diego, and now we're working our way back up to Oregon and Washington and possibly Vancouver. And then we're going to be heading across the country on our way to PaleoFX in Austin. So we'll be doing Idaho, Utah, Nevada, Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, which that should be really fun. But we're having a blast.
It sounds like fun.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, travel by car, especially for people that are autoimmune, for the past couple of years, I've had a really hard time flying. And I thought that it was traveling that was hard on me, but I've discovered that it's actually flying, not traveling. So being able to have the car and have a cooler full of food and, you know, drive a few hours and then get out of the car and take a hike or something, it's like totally revolutionized how I feel when I'm moving from place to place and city to city. It's nowhere near as draining as it is when I fly.
That's fascinating, because I know Sarah struggles with feeling really run down after she travels. And my good friend Jennifer from Predominantly Paleo physically says that she like has lost feeling in her legs and just has really, really bad nerve issues coming off of flying. But that like you, driving isn't so much a problem if she can get out every couple of hours and kind of walk around and stuff. So that's a good option for people who are afraid to travel, although obviously driving isn't as convenient, but.
Yeah. It's definitely not as convenient, but I mean, it kind of goes along with the slower, I think the slower paced life that I'm learning to enjoy a little bit more, arriving to a city, getting my bearings for maybe a day or two before doing a signing and hang out with people. And, I know it's totally different when you have kids and life and work and all that kind of stuff. So we feel really blessed that we're able to do this right now, but it's been totally rad.
I have all kinds of like mixed emotions of like jealousy, but then again, like, I'm so glad I don't have to go anywhere right now. And the other thing about road trips, though, I think that's a little bit different from flying is that you've got a partner, right? Like, I think when you're driving those kinds of like long road trips and you're completely by yourself, it can be definitely a lot more draining than when you have someone to share the driving with and someone to talk to. And, you know, that part of it, I think that we sort of underestimate the part about traveling that's really stress. And I think that's one of the reasons why flying can be so hard on all of us is because you've got this like, it's this hurry up and wait, right? And so you're like constantly like, am I going late? Am I going to make it? Am I going to get there on time? And you've got to go through, you know, this line and this line and this line. And then you have to get through TSA and then you get online. You never know, you know, if it's going to be on time, if you're going to make your connection. And there's that psychological stress associated with flying that I think when you have the control and you're the one driving and you like, you know, what's going on. And you like, I feel like that's probably a huge aspect to why it's a more enjoyable method of travel. It just has, right. You sort of, from the beginning, you kind of accept that it's got more flexibility and it's got more space and it's, you know, you kind of have this, I don't know. It's a very different mentality compared to flying. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's good.
Secure. You know what I mean? Like I've got like my bag of supplements. It's not just the stuff I take on the regular basis, but the stuff that I take when I get sick or.
You can bring all kinds of fluids in a car.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my gosh. So part of what I did was I came down to Berkeley and I spent a week at Mission Heirloom, which I know you guys both ate at. We all ate there at AHS, and they're a restaurant that just opened that serves AIP food, and you can take food to go in the little jars. And we brought a cooler. And so we bought like a week's worth of food that they pressure can in these jars, because I knew that I was going to be, once I got to LA, I was going to be staying with my dad who eats gluten and it's all over his kitchen. And so while I'm here, I'm just literally heating up the Mission Heirloom food. Like I'm not even cooking, and it makes it so convenient. I can't even tell you.
Tasty.
Yeah, and it makes me want to move to Berkeley because their food is so good and it's just so easy to be able to go somewhere and pick stuff up that it's like ridiculous.
They're also super nice people.
Yeah, no, they're totally rad. And the place is beautiful. I know you guys haven't seen the restaurant yet, but if you ever get a chance to be there, you'll flip. It's awesome.
I will figure out a chance to be there.
You should do it.
So, I know that we're obviously discussing Hashi's part deux. Sarah, did you have some science in mind or something else?
I would love to do some science.
Let's do it.
It's just like stress relief for me.
Right? Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys.
So, you know, last week, I think we kind of jumped in on a lot of the what to do about hypothyroidism. And I thought this week it might be nice to actually probably do what I should have done last week. Probably should have switched these. But to talk a little bit about what the thyroid does and why there are certain symptoms of hypothyroidism, like how those come about. And especially for me, because weight gain was probably my earliest symptom. And I, in my week and a half of reflection, believe that my battles with weight really started with Hashimoto's thyroiditis, and that that one of the reasons why this particular health battle has been so prominent in my life is because my thyroid hasn't been working properly. So the hormones that are produced by the thyroid gland is an endocrine gland, and it's in your neck, just below your voice box. And the thyroids that it produces control metabolism and how, you know, individual cells use energy. It controls growth and development, so it can have a profound effect when it's not working properly in children. It controls body temperature, which is why I have the chills, especially in the evening. It controls heart rate and blood pressure. That's one of the reasons why a racing heart rate is a symptom of an overactive thyroid. It controls how calcium is used by the body, including getting it into bones, which is why things like osteoporosis can be long-term side effects of hypothyroidism. And I think what's potentially more importantly is that it controls how sensitive the body is to other hormones. So it really controls how other hormones are signaling. And there's a really strong connection between thyroid function, certain neurotransmitters, the adrenal axis, so stress hormones, and the gonadal axis, so sex hormones. And it's why, for example, it's so common to see sex hormone imbalances and adrenal fatigue with hypothyroidism, which, of course, I have that entire trifecta. Woohoo! That was a sarcastic woohoo, everyone, just to make sure that's completely clear. So when it comes to weight gain, and certainly not every person with Hashimoto's experiences weight gain, and there's a fairly substantial group of people, Mickey is one of them, who never, you know, was overweight and was actually, Mickey, you can maybe tell the story yourself, but, you know, hypothyroidism was ruled out as a possibility with your symptoms because you didn't have weight gain. So it's certainly not everyone who experiences this. But the way that hypothyroidism is sort of permissive for weight gain is it comes at it from two different sides. So the first one is I just mentioned that thyroid hormones control metabolism and how cells use energy. And so when your thyroid is underproductive, so you have hypothyroidism and you're not producing enough active thyroid hormone, that actually drops your metabolic rate. So you need fewer calories to maintain your weight. And you're basically everything you're doing, you're burning fewer calories, whether you're sitting or whether you're exercising, you're not burning as many calories as if you had a normally functioning thyroid. But thyroid hormones, as I mentioned, they can also interact with a lot of neurotransmitters in the brain. And one of the things that thyroid does is it actually changes how sensitive the neurons in your brain are that are controlling the sensation of hunger and satiety, it changes how sensitive those neurons are to receiving the signals from other hormones. So hunger is and satiety, so like being hungry and being full and the whole spectrum in between, that sensation is controlled by a fairly large group of hormones that are produced in a variety of different tissues down the digestive tract. And those are hormones like insulin and leptin and ghrelin, which I think a lot of people have heard of, but also things like cortisol and glucagon and cholecystokinin, oxytomodulin, peptide YY, glucagon-like peptide 1. And all of these hormones, the way they signal to the brain, whether you're hungry or you're full or the spectrum in between, is by binding with something called neuropeptide Y. And all these hormones either increase the receptor for neuropeptide Y or increase neuropeptide Y itself. And that activates these neurons that then translate that binding, that hormone binding to its receptor as hunger or satiety. So generally, if you activate these neurons, you're activating the sensation of hunger. And if you deactivate these neurons, you are activating the sensation of being full. So thyroid hormones, especially the active thyroid hormone T3, increases sensitivity of these neurons so that it's easier to turn them off and turn them on. And specifically, it's easier to turn them off with normal T3 levels. So when you have decreased thyroid, it actually makes it harder for those neurons to respond to the signals from the hunger hormones. And so for some people, this can actually translate in not feeling hungry when they are hungry. That seems to be a minority of people, but that is why some people with hypothyroidism can be actually underweight compared to overweight. But for the majority of people, what happens is it becomes really, really hard to turn these neurons off. So it makes us really hard to know when we've eaten enough. And it makes portion control extremely challenging because our bodies are hungry. Like even when you're listening to your body is saying, eat more. It's just that your body's lying, but it's still, that's the same. That's the sensation. The sensation is hunger and appetite. And so hyperthyroidism then becomes permissive for weight gain because it not only slows your metabolism, it means that you need fewer calories, but it increases your appetite so that if you're not really restrained in how you're eating, it makes it so that you naturally consume more calories. And definitely that's the side of the equation that I fell on. And so for me, you know, when I look back at my life, I can basically measure when Hashimoto's thyroiditis started with when I started getting teased for my weight. Like that to me was pretty much the beginning. It's not really helpful for somebody who's going through it other than to understand that that's one of the reasons why if your thyroid's not up to snuff, even on the autoimmune protocol that, that we suggest, you know, talking to your doctor about being on, a thyroid hormone replacement. And there's lots of different options and Mickey is much more versed in those options than I am. That's also a discussion that really needs to happen with your healthcare provider. But that's why we generally don't recommend that very cavalier, since I'm on the autoimmune protocol, I can stop all my medicines. And that sort of instinct that many people have that because they're tackling things with diet and lifestyle and they're feeling better, that means that they can just neglect medications because, you know, this disease is a disease caused by the immune system damaging that organ. And so even when you start to regulate the immune system, there's a lot of damage that needs to heal. And some of that damage may be permanent damage. And you don't really know until you go through the process. But it's why it's important when you're changing your diet and you have either high, you know, low thyroid or high thyroid. So it would work for, Graves' disease or someone who had Graves' disease treated with radioablation. But it's why it's so important to do frequent testing for thyroid, because while you're in that healing journey, there can be, again, sort of a lot of tinkering that needs to happen with thyroid dose. That was a lot.
It's science. You do science. That's what you do.
Mickey, do you have science?
You have any additional thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was an incredible explanation, and I often struggle to talk to people that have the weight gain as a symptom, because personally, that wasn't something that I struggled with to an extreme level. My experience was that I was eating like 1,200 calories of carrot sticks, and I gained 10 pounds, which isn't a lot in the scope of things, but I was like, what's going on with my body right now? Like, how is this, you know, how is this working? And I totally understand now how that happens. And it's just so crazy how some people have the experience, like you did from a very young age, Sarah, where weight gain was the first symptom. And I can trace my Hashimoto's to when I was a teenager and going through puberty. And weight gain was not any part of the equation, but I did have like the shedding hair. I had numbness and tingling in my fingers. So I think it really depends on the person and their hormonal balance, really how it's going to manifest that low hormone and what other things it's going to kind of trigger, you know?
Can I ask you a total tangent question?
Yeah.
Do you still have tingling in your fingers now after AIP and proper medication and everything?
No. And you know what's really crazy is it took a really, really long time to go away, like probably a year and a half. I thought that it was the one thing that would never go away because, you know, I thought it was nerve damage. I didn't think that it was nutritional deficiency for a while. I thought it was B12. At one point, you know, I thought it could be anemia, but I got sufficient in all of those things and it was still there. But really over like a year and a half of AIP, it slowly went away and slowly went away to the point where I haven't had it now probably in another year and a half.
So I've had tingling in my fingers and my whole arms will go numb, especially when I'm sleeping. And it's,
yeah, I actually noticed, Sarah, that, my arms would go numb laying in like a normal, on my back in a normal flat position, mm-hmm. with like no pressure on my arms in either direction, they would go numb.
Yes. I experienced that and it's very annoying. So I don't know if this is for sure why, but it turns out that thyroglobulin has a important role in myelination. So I think that it's probably a demyelination of some of the nerves, and that's why tingling extremities is a symptom of Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And that would explain why, sort of supporting thyroid function and, it would explain why just say putting Synthroid on it wouldn't necessarily help and why it would take a longer period of time to heal and why something like, you know, autoimmune protocol where you're stopping the attack on your thyroid and supporting that system, which is not, it's sort of tangential to what the thyroid does. I think that sort of explains why it takes so long, but it's very annoying. I don't like it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that totally makes sense, Sarah. I think you're right on the mark there.
It's kind of disturbing for me to hear, I'm going to be really honest, and I know we're going to ask a question that's kind of going to touch on this later that I feel like I maybe anonymously submitted on my own behalf, but a lot of the symptoms that you guys talk about are things that I too have, like the numbing of my arms when I'm sleeping, which I never would have attributed to being some sort of thing. So it'll be interesting for me. I'm looking for, already since Sarah got diagnosed, a legitimate doctor in this area. We have such good medicine in this area, but it's difficult to find a doctor who knows what they're reading for a full thyroid panel that also takes health insurance, which is, I'm like crossing my fingers to try to find somebody. So,
I pay out of pocket for mine.
Yeah. Well, so supposedly I did find someone, but we haven't been able to book an appointment yet. When Matt calls, he hasn't gotten through. So I'm hopeful it was recommended, this person. So if not, I will just have to. But at the same time, it really bothers me that this is something, this is like a legitimate health problem that you can run a test for. Like, it's, there are some autoimmune diseases that can't be identified on a test. And so the fact that people just aren't educated on how to test and what they're reading is really frustrating.
Well, and I always had normal TSH. So that's one of the things we talked about last week, is sort of like a standard test is either just thyroid stimulating hormone or TSH, or the combination of TSH and T4, right, Mickey? T4?
Yeah, but it's usually serum T4. It's usually not free T4. Yeah.
So that is, that really is only going to show you if things, like if the wheels have completely fallen off the cart, and it doesn't show you the entire span of gray in between critical low thyroid function and normal. And you can be in a really dysfunctional state, and like my TSH still, although just barely, is still normal. It's not particularly elevated, and it's still within the normal lab range, probably because I've been propping myself up on caffeine since I was 14, and caffeine decreases TSH. So there's probably that. But I think that there's a lot of ways that people with low thyroid, I think there's a lot of ways that we manage the symptoms. Like, I think for me, this was a collection of symptoms that I never would have thought to tell a doctor when I was 12 years old. Like, I didn't, right? Teenagers sleep a lot. Teenagers are moody. My carpal tunnel ran in my family, although probably Hashimoto's thyroiditis runs in my family, but tons of my family members had carpal tunnel. So I just figured the numbness was carpal tunnel syndrome. I was constipated, but who wants to go talk to their doctor about being constipated? I just took all of the super easy to get, you know, medications for constipation, until it became critical in my early 20s. And I went through the whole diagnosis and was diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome. Like, and I look at this collection of symptoms that, you know, some of them really embarrassing symptoms that I wouldn't even mention to my friends or my parents. I wouldn't have even known that they were wrong. Like, I just didn't want to talk about my breasts to anybody when I was a teenager, because like, what girl going through puberty wants to have that conversation? And so I just didn't think that milk coming out of my breasts at 11, I just thought, well, maybe that's just puberty and that's what all of the girls are going through, right? Like, I didn't realize that was potentially a symptom of low thyroid. I didn't realize, right, that the milk overproduction that I was experiencing when my babies were born could be a symptom of like low thyroid. Like, it seems like this collection of completely not linked random things. And I think that so many of us sort of go through life blaming ourselves for our weight issues, because clearly it's our fault and we must be doing something wrong, right? We're overeating, but not realizing that that's a physiological response to something that's going wrong, and not realizing that, you know, our energy levels are abnormal. You know, we just say, well, you know, we're so out of shape and that's why we have such low energy, right? We're so, I think especially as women, and of course Hashimoto's affects far more women than does men, I think we're so used to ignoring it and shoving it to the side and not worrying about it or finding the easy fix at the drugstore. And I think that it's a real problem that we're not testing for this effectively, and that there are estimates that up to 10% of people have low functioning thyroid. 10%, 1 in 10. That is a ridiculously huge number of people. And there's no awareness. So if you can't tell from the soapbox I'm on right now, it kind of makes me a little bit angry, having been sort of in that part where I look back at the symptoms and realize I've had this since I was a kid. And it makes me angry that anybody else has to go through that. That was me getting emotional again.
Rah, rah. I'm with you on that soapbox.
So we promised a normal length show, but we haven't even gotten to questions yet. So I think we should answer some questions.
Let's do it.
Questions and Answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
Our first question is from Callie. Callie says, I have Hashimoto's, still taking 50 micrograms of levothyroxine. Have struggled with debilitating belly aches my whole life, which greatly improved when I went paleo AIP on doctor's orders, just an aside for a woo woo, 30 days ago. Okay, so the first 20 days of being AIP, I was starving. I was very low calorie with no snacking and had zero belly aches. Now that I'm becoming more comfortable with what I can eat, I'm eating quite a bit throughout the day and grazing, and the tummy aches and gas are coming back. I'm wondering if it's something I'm eating, yams and coconut products and fruits galore, or if I'm eating too much. I was so thrilled to have escaped the tummy aches, and now I'm disheartened because they seem to be coming back. What gives? I'm taking digestive enzymes. Please, please help. Thanks a million for your podcast and websites. You are such a wonderful comforting source of information.
I'm sure you and Mickey are going to tackle this from a Hashi's perspective. I mean, my first thought is, why is she taking digestive enzymes? Is it just to kind of help because she has digestive problems, or if she doesn't have a gallbladder, I would refer her to, because I don't think that was included, and sometimes people just forget that that's important. So if that's a reason that she's taking them, I would refer her to some of our gallbladder shows, and Sarah and I both have posts on our website with more information about helping regulate digestion.
Mickey, do you want to
add
to the conversation?
My first thought would just be that maybe she has something pathogenic. It's super, super common with people with autoimmune disease, but with Hashi's too. And especially if someone starts AIP and then they continue to have some like digestive symptoms, especially like tummy aches and gas, that sounds a lot like there might be something going on in there that like a stool test or being tested for SIBO could really help. Another thing she could try, like the snacking throughout the day, sounds like it's fruit and veg kind of a snacks, and both of those, like from the SIBO side of things, could flare stuff up. And then a lot of people don't really tolerate raw vegetables very well, so I don't know if she's like snacking on like carrots or celery or something. That's totally something that I would do. And I notice that a lot of that raw veg kind of irritates my stomach so sometimes. So maybe she could try doing like all cooked food, soups, stews, purees, that kind of stuff, to see if that has to do with anything.
Yeah, both awesome. The other thing that it makes me think of, because she's talking about belly aches but also gas, and she's eating a lot of sweet potatoes and coconut products and fruit, it makes me think of FODMAP intolerance, because that is one of the major symptoms of FODMAP intolerance. And that also can be fairly common, especially with somebody sort of newly paleo and, you know, maybe taking digestive enzymes because of gastrointestinal symptoms, and maybe not necessarily absorbing a lot of stuff. So has some other sort of barriers to proper digestion. So those are all, right, like a lot of fruit or high FODMAP, especially if you're eating a lot of fruit, period, that's a lot of fructose and fructose-based sugars. Coconut products are very, very high in inulin fiber, which is a FODMAP, and so are sweet potatoes. So the other way to go is, I mean, you could do a FODMAP test, but a fructose malabsorption test. But if it is fructose malabsorption, it can make things really bad to just do the test. Or you could just do like a 2-week trial of low FODMAP and sort of have a look at, you know, how to keep eating more so that you're not doing a really low calorie diet, because that's not going to be great for your thyroid. But sticking with other alternatives for starches and carbs and vegetables in general. And then you can combine that with the idea of sticking with cooked ones so that they're easier to digest. And grazing can be hard on the stomach too. So you know, maybe trying to pull back a little bit to, you know, maybe four meals a day. If, you know, it can be a really hard transition on the body to go from grazing to three big meals, but to go to more distinct, right, meals and snacks, even if they're not sort of the optimal 5 to 7 hours apart, but stick to 3 hours apart and kind of space things apart a little bit. Because when you graze, you don't really have enough time to build up enough stomach acid to properly digest the next bolus of food. So it's better from a hormonal perspective and from a digestion perspective to space food apart. So there's a whole lot of things to try right there.
Sounds good to me.
Awkward pause. All right. Sorry about that. Okay, so our next question is from Molly. And Molly says, "Hi, ladies. I'm loving your podcast. I stumbled upon you a few weeks ago and I've been trying to catch up with all the episodes I have missed." And Molly, we're sorry.
Hey, that's my line.
We were awkward in the beginning. There's some awkwardness back in the olden days that people get to listen to when they do that. All right. I'll continue reading Molly's question. "I've been eating a whole foods-based diet now for about 10 months. It started with a Whole30 last spring. I generally eat paleo, but not exactly 100%. I am 100% gluten-free, but I don't fret too much about the occasional serving of rice or legumes, for example. I liked a recent Chris Kresser article about whether legumes are paleo and who really cares. Overall, I'm totally committed to eating real food and purchase as much organic and local food as I can. I have not noticed significant issues with some of these clean but non-paleo foods in terms of what it does to my body, bloating or gas, etc. Therefore, I tend to eat what feels good and not worry too much if it's officially classified as paleo. What I consider cheating may be the occasional gluten-free rice crackers, gluten-free pizza crust, or gluten-free alcohol. That said, my biggest concern is that I seem to be unable to lose weight on a whole foods-based diet. I definitely have weight to lose, like 40 to 50 pounds, so it's not those 5 vanity pounds I hear some crazy people being concerned about. I've been working with a local nutritionist for all these months. She is totally on board with the whole foods movement and is very up to speed on current science. I spent quite a lot of money on different lab tests, testing for hormone levels, micronutrient deficiencies, full thyroid panels, metabolic panels, vitamin D levels, ferritin levels. I tested negative for the MTHFR mutation. Suffice it to say, we have been digging pretty deep to uncover what might be my roadblock. Generally speaking, the nutritionist and compounding pharmacist I have been working with keep telling me my labs are indicating I am a healthy individual. My biggest frustrations are my inability to lose weight and my chronic constipation, although I take probiotics and magnesium every day. Eating something with chia seeds has turned out to be the best thing for constipation. However, I'm very irregular and perhaps could go 1 to 3 days without a movement. I feel like this is a sign that things are not quite right in my system. I just wondered if you have any thoughts right off the bat of paths I could explore. I did discover some micronutrient deficiencies, which I am addressing with my nutritionist, mainly through the addition of supplements because I can't consume more vegetables than I already do every day. I was quite low in most of my B vitamins, and my serine levels were very low. The SpectraCell test also indicated I am insulin resistant, and my diet has been designed to break through the insulin resistance, but it's just not happening. Is it possible that I have an autoimmune condition that I don't even know about? I have no skin issues or general ailments other than my constipation and inability to lose weight. Is it possible I have an underlying autoimmune issue even if I cannot see or feel visible symptoms? I've been a yo-yo dieter all my life. I'm totally on board with the whole foods diet movement, and I want to really be a cheerleader for the movement, but it's so hard to keep the faith when I have been trying for so many months to lose weight, and I don't even have a single pound of weight lost. I think my family and friends are perhaps wondering why I go through such great lengths to eat the way I do and appear to not have any weight loss success. I do believe good things are perhaps happening on the inside. I'm running out of steam trying to stay positive. I feel like a lot of people start out with skin issues, digestion issues, bodily pain, autoimmune systems, etc. To be honest, I felt good before I started paleo. I feel pretty much the same as I did when I ate a standard American diet. I have not experienced the boundless amounts of energy or other exciting results that most people seem to experience when they change from a SAD diet to paleo. My issues are weight and constipation. If neither of these things can be addressed by my paleo diet, then something seems to be off. Also, I should mention that I'm going to try to get pregnant within the next few months. So I am also focused on just getting as healthy as possible, but I hate the idea of going into pregnancy so overweight. Any advice or just plain encouragement you can provide would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Okay, before you guys jump into the bulk of it, I want to address the very last pregnancy piece. And it might not be a popular response, and I'll let, you know, Sarah provide you some science if she disagrees, but the medical literature and like the paleo perspective on preparing for pregnancy is to nourish your body as much as possible. And this idea that Sarah and I talk about a lot of times to focus on health and not weight loss is something that I think I really, really, really want this individual to focus on right now. So I would advise her to go back and listen to our Soapbox episodes on, what did you call it? Metric of Health. Is that what that episode was? But, it's if the focus right now, and I hear her saying that she wants to eat healthy foods, which is great, but I also hear more strongly coming through that weight loss is really important to her. And I had three healthy pregnancies as an obese woman. That's not to say that every obese pregnancy will be healthy, and that's also not to say that every pregnancy for women who are at their ideal weight will be healthy. But for me, if I wanted to have another pregnancy, my focus would be on eating the most nutrient-dense foods that I possibly could. And we're talking about like the AIP kind of superfoods, phase three paleo of real life paleo, you know, that perspective on as many vegetables as you can eat, you know, organ meat, broth, seafood, pastured egg yolks, and pastured ruminant meat. So I try to have one of those things, if not two of those things, in every meal that I consume, with the exception of course, I'm not a perfectionist, but if I were about to get pregnant, that would absolutely be my focus. And if weight loss occurs, great, but it, in my opinion, should be, I don't like the word should, would ideally be secondary to really creating nourishment in your body. Because what will happen is if you get pregnant and you're micronutrient deficient, and you can't, and you're not consuming the foods, and you don't have like a pool of those nutrients to give to the growing human being that you're going to grow, like you have to grow bones. That's going to take calcium from your body. So if you don't focus on your nutrition yourself and get in those really nutrient dense foods, then it negatively affects your body. And Sarah and I have both talked about before how almost all women end up with cavities after pregnancies because the calcium leaches from your body into creating bones for little babies. So, sorry, I just had to have my little like rant about that because I'm in this like really big phase right now about being healthy.
I think that was awesome. One of the reasons why I wanted to include this question in a podcast that was sort of themed about Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And we can talk about some of the other things that might be going on that might be stalling weight loss. And I actually had a blog post that went live just this morning about the connection between weight and sleep, which Molly doesn't actually talk about, you know, how her sleep is. And I think we're getting very, very focused on nutrition and diet and maybe to the detriment of some of the lifestyle factors. But I thought what was interesting in it is she mentions having weight to lose, she mentions chronic constipation, and she mentions, she doesn't really mention being low energy, but she mentions that she's not seeing this dramatic increase in energy that other people get from changing to a paleo diet. And those are three symptoms of hypothyroidism, but she mentions that that they actually did a full thyroid panel and it came back normal. So Mickey, I thought it'd be kind of interesting to talk about some other ways maybe that hypothyroidism might be diagnosed or other things to look for in case that's maybe one of the things that's sort of underlying Molly's frustrating resistance to weight loss.
Yeah, totally. I think this is an awesome thing to talk about because a lot of people have this experience. I had this experience, I think, four times before I actually got my diagnosis. And the way that I figured out I had Hashimoto's was through Dr. Google, and I came across it. And when I started reading about the disease, I knew I had it. And it took me 4 doctors who ran thyroid panels that came back normal before I could find one that actually gave me the diagnosis. And the reason why this happens is because most doctors will check TSH, and they'll check total T4, and sometimes they'll check total T3. And none of these lab tests are enough to actually give a diagnosis of Hashimoto's. In my opinion, they will only tell if your thyroid is very, very far gone. So if someone's TSH is like super high, that'll be a red flag. But what I know, and what a lot of us in the functional medicine community have figured out, is that you can have someone who's experiencing symptoms with a normal TSH and a normal total T4 and a normal total T3. So there are definitely some other tests that are needed to figure out what's actually going on. And so the 2 antibody tests that I tell everyone to go order if they suspect a thyroid issue are TPO antibodies and thyroglobulin antibodies. Both of them, if they come back positive, they are indicative of Hashimoto's. And I've got TPO antibodies. Some people have both. Some have one or the other.
I've got thyroglobulins between the 2 of us. We've got Hashis covered.
Yeah, team Hashis. But in addition to that, so that'll tell you basically yes or no if you are making antibodies. I have heard some people say that their doctor won't diagnose them officially with Hashimoto's if they have high antibodies, but their other labs are normal. But I think the common medically accepted way of diagnosing is if you have positive antibodies above the reference range, then that does indicate that you have the autoimmune disease. And so the other lab tests that are really useful are free T4 and free T3. And the free in front of the T3 and the T4 are extremely important. And if you request this, a lot of what you will get is total T3 and T4, because it's such a different test that our regular conventional practitioners are not used to ordering, that they will literally mishear what you're saying and not look for the actual test. So you have to be very specific if you're asking your doctor, your endocrinologist, your PA, or whatever. You want to tell them that you want the free. And this is because it'll actually tell you the active hormone that's circulating in your bloodstream, which makes the most sense for figuring out if your symptoms are correlating with a low hormone level. And you can also see if you're having a conversion issue. So that would mean, I think, Sarah, you said that you guys explained thyroid your mm-hmm. last episode, so I don't really have to go over T4 and T3. But basically, if you've got low T4, it means your thyroid's not making enough. If you've got low T4 and low T3, you're not making enough and you're not converting. If you have regular T4 and low T3, it just means you're not converting. So people with Hashimoto's usually have either low T4 or low T4 and low T3. People, regular people that don't have Hashimoto's but have a thyroid problem can have low T3. And the T3 is the blood test. The free T3 is the one that I think practitioners are most resistant to ordering. And it's kind of ironic because that's the lab test that correlates the best with how people feel and my personal experience in working with people with Hashimoto's. So for anyone that suspects a thyroid problem, I think in addition to TSH, free T3, free T4, both the antibodies, TPO and thyroglobulin, and reverse T3 is also really helpful because you can use that to find a ratio to figure out if the T3 conversion is bad due to adrenal fatigue, which is another whole thing.
Right. And something that we maybe should mention, but I first wanted to ask you about thyroid sonograms and how sensitive you think those are.
Yeah. And so I've actually heard that some people don't make antibodies, but they have had the ultrasound or the sonogram. Is that the same thing?
Yes.
Okay. Just making sure. Is that a Canadian thing?
I think it's an old, it's an old person thing.
Okay.
to call it a sonogram compared to ultrasound is a young person thing. Okay. Makes me old. That's all.
Sounds good. So yeah, you can actually be diagnosed with Hashimoto's if you don't have antibodies, but you have an ultrasound and it shows that your thyroid is inflamed. That is some way, another way that some people get a diagnosis. So it is possible to have Hashimoto's without antibodies. And it probably means that you have antibodies to something that we don't know how to measure yet, but it is affecting your thyroid.
I actually was talking to a person today who had symptoms of low thyroid, but her thyroid test kept coming back normal. So they did a ultrasound and found that she did have inflammation, but also pitting. So there's sort of little pockets of dead tissue in the thyroid. And that was a definitive diagnosis for Hashimoto's thyroiditis, according to her endocrinologist. So that's another way to go when the blood tests are showing up normal. So there can still be damage to the thyroid, but it's still not working optimally. And the other thing to add to what Mickey said is that lab reference ranges are based on average. So we think of them as being normal, but they're not normal. They are average. And when you look at the average health of Americans, that might not be where you want to be. And so there is a lot of information out there on the internet. I think the Institute for Functional Medicine has an article. I think there's a few other places where you can get the information, but there's a narrower range that's sort of considered the optimal range. And it means that you can have low thyroid, but if you have a doctor who's just going based on the lab reference ranges and just looking to see if the lab that ran the blood test says high or low, they may not be looking in detail enough to be able to diagnose. But if you have a functional medicine specialist, an integrative medicine doctor, somebody who's more educated in terms of not just what the lab ranges are, but what's optimal thyroid function, they may look at those numbers and diagnose as hypo or thyroid or hyper or whatever, but abnormal thyroid. Based not on the lab reference ranges, but on this sort of tighter range that's considered optimal for those measurements.
Yeah. And I would even add, even if you have a rock star doctor, if you have Hashimoto's, you need to learn how to read your own blood work. You need to print out all your lab work, keep it in a binder, and every appointment go over it, because it's not, you just can't hand the wheel to someone else and expect them to be able to fix you. You really have to be on top of it and know, like, hey, I was feeling good when my levels looked like this. Because that point is different for everyone. And, you know, no doctor really knows what you're going to feel good at.
Oh, that was depressing. I mean, and empowering at the same time. But it just made me feel like the goal numbers are not necessarily what my goal numbers are. And that kind of made me feel like this is going to be a long road. I think that's one of the things about Hashimoto's thyroiditis that can be so frustrating for people, is getting to that point of stability can be a lot of effort and a long time.
Yeah. But I mean, Sarah, like taking notes, like, I did it for a long time, and I mean, I didn't take notes and I didn't care. And then when I looked back, it made a lot more sense. So, you know, you have so much more information than a lot of people do when they're starting out, and, you know, just keeping track, like, hey, I feel good right now. Let's see if I can write down or like take note on my latest lab work, because like I personally have found, you know, my free T3 level to correlate best towards my symptoms. But, you know, the range is like 2.5 to like 4.5, which is like a really big range. But I feel completely different if my level is like 2.2 versus like 2.4. It's like you would think on paper, like a doctor would look at that and be like, you can't even tell. But it's like the difference between me like sleeping in bed for 16 hours a day and like having a party. Like it's really crazy. And you know, some people that's true. Like I notice a really small improvement, and some people, you know, they'll take medication and their improvement will be really drastic and they might not even feel it. So you kind of have to keep those notes so that you can figure out, you know, what's best for you. And that's definitely hard.
Hard yet empowering. And I think one of the most important things that we can do is find a healthcare provider who's willing to look at symptoms as part of the equation and not just look at those numbers. Cause I think that's really, really important with Hashimoto's thyroiditis. So just a couple of other things I wanted to add to the answer to Molly's question. It doesn't sound like she's tested for adrenal fatigue. That is something that could be going on. She does say that she's tested for hormone levels, but doesn't specify whether that's estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, DHEA. Those things could be out of whack, and also culprits, not getting enough sleep, unmanaged stress. And it sounds like maybe the inability to lose weight may be a psychological stressor in itself. Being overactive, being underactive and sedentary, overeating calories. So maybe, you know, doing the paleo thing where you eat almond butter by the spoonful, that could be a problem. Going the other direction and being so used to calorie restricting that we calorie restrict on paleo and undereating calories can be the problem because that slows metabolic rate. I mentioned sleep, right? We can have Monica point to my post that talks about why inadequate sleep leads to weight gain that I posted today. And always the possibility that, as Stacey mentioned right off the bat, that, your body's healthy right now. And that this is actually a really good weight for your body, and that your body doesn't want to lose those 50 pounds, and that you're actually optimally healthy right now. We base our ideas of what is a healthy weight based on sort of an average again, and based on body fat percentages that we think are good. But we don't really have an idea of how genetics might factor into that equation, how genetics might actually impact what's ideal and what's not ideal. So that's also a possibility. I think there's a lot of other avenues to explore before necessarily sort of having to go through the emotional process of accepting that.
Yeah, I've got a couple things to add to Sarah, if that's okay,
mm-hmm.
Stacey. So it sounds like she's got a really good perspective on balance, which I think is really awesome for people that have kind of figured out an optimal diet for themselves. But I think in her situation where she's kind of searching for a deeper issue, it might not be a bad idea to try a strict autoimmune protocol for a month just to see what happens, you know? Because I know for some people, there are some ingredients in things like she was talking about her cheat meals, like gluten-free pizza, crackers, glass of alcohol here or there. Those can really make or break the whole like symptom picture for some people. And so I'd be curious to see if she tried that for a month to see if anything changed, you know?
Yeah, I think it's a really good idea. Because one of the things that could be going on, not just undiagnosed autoimmune issues or inflammation, your body will hold on to weight if it's inflamed, but is also food sensitivities. And maybe it's totally possible to have a food sensitivity and have absolutely zero gastrointestinal symptoms.
Well, she has constipation, so that is a
gastrointestinal symptom.
Yeah, I mean, it could be eggs, it could be nuts. You know, those are two that I think cause constipation in some people. It could be the thickeners in some
dairy
of the foods.
Dairy is a major culprit. And she doesn't actually mention whether or not she's eating dairy, but if she's got a more relaxed view of paleo, that she may be eating high-quality dairy. And that is one of the main ways that dairy impacted my body was constipation and migraines, which also hard to ignore. But yeah, so doing something like an autoimmune protocol, which really eliminates the majority of the potentially problematic foods from an inflammation standpoint. I like that idea. I feel silly not having said that idea, but I'm glad you're here.
It's okay. I kind of work for you and I'm under your umbrella, so we can smartness.
Excellent. Did you have anything else you wanted to add?
I think that's it. Just, you know, in addition to kind of the deeper testing and maybe getting someone else's eye on, like, specifically what supplements she's taking, like the probiotics, some of them can make constipation worse. You know, like Prescriptocyst and Bifidobacter species tend to be pretty good at loosening things up for some people. So, you know, checking that out.
So, Stacey, are you still with us?
I am.
Sweet.
So, Mickey, thank you so much for coming on, and it's great to hear from you. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your tour, and I'm happy to hear that it's going so well for you, because for many of us, we come back from tour and crash. So it sounds like you've got a good thing going that we can all learn from, that slow pace, that slow pace life, which, as you noted, is a bit more difficult when you have children and job and all that, you know, all that kind of stuff. So nevertheless, it's a great example for us all. And I hope you have a wonderful, successful tour, and, you know, let us know if you come to the East Coast. I know you're talking about doing that later, so definitely keep us clued in.
Thanks, Stacey. That's really nice of you to say.
So let's also remind people where they can find you, Mickey. You are easily found at autoimmune-paleo.com.
Yep.
And that links to all of your social media. But also thepaleomomconsulting.com, because as alluded to previously, Mickey is one of the consultants that work for my consulting company. So if you like all of her nerdy knowledge, which I do, you can go to thepaleomomconsulting.com and sign up to be a client.
Heck yeah.
So thank you so much, Mickey, not just for joining us for tonight, but for all of your support over the last couple weeks and months and years. And I hope the rest of your tour is awesome.
Thank you, Sarah. I really, I know personally what you're going through, and it makes me really sad to know that my friend is going through that. It like totally sucks. And it actually really sucks that you're not my first friend. You're like my fourth friend that's going through this. So it's kind of a sad reality that I get to coach through my friends, through this horrible thing that I experienced. But, I think you've got a lot of tools and you're going to be great and you're going to help a lot of people, which is the most awesome part. So thanks to both of you for having me on the podcast and letting me share some of my knowledge.
Thank you, Mickey. And thanks everyone for listening.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.